and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that definitely had time to wash and dry this t-shirt between recordings, and in no way was this recorded back-to-back with the intro for last week's episode. I'm one of your hosts, John Bruford, joined by your other host, Fintan Costello.
Hey, John.
Hello, Fintan. How are you?
I'm good.
Great.
You okay?
Yes, I am well. Mildly disturbed by, you know, the world. But apart from that, everything's great.
Good.
Ish. Have you heard any good jokes lately?
No. Oh, I have. Sorry. What do you call a one-legged hippo?
A hopper? I've never heard that before. It was a lucky guess.
It made me giggle.
Was that while you're in Dublin and drunk?
No, it was before I went to Dublin. I heard that one.
Okay. I really can't think of any. I mean, I can't think of any apart from my old favourites. Which is a shame. I haven't had a good joke for ages. I'm not dissing your joke when I say that.
That was a classic. It's okay.
I just finished watching the Goosebumps series on Disney Plus.
Oh yeah.
It was surprisingly good.
Is it based on the kids' books?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But it's you know, for something for sort of younger teens, that kind of thing, it's really nicely balanced. It's really well done. It's two episodes too long, but apart from that, really enjoyed it. And nice. Even the two episodes that were too long were fine. So, yeah, so there was that. So I guess probably start Muppets Mayhem next. It does look pretty good.
Oh, was that the new one they did?
Yeah.
We started watching that, and we stopped for some reason. I think we forgot about it. But yeah, I watched a couple of episodes. It was really good.
Yeah, I've heard it's really good. Mm. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, life-wise, just not a lot going on. You know, eat, work, sleep, beat the children. Oh, we shouldn't say that. We live in Wales. It's illegal here.
Beat the children at board games.
Yes, that's exactly what I meant. Because that they learn resilience from that eventually. If you beat them enough at board games. Yeah. So we've got a bit of a star guest on this episode.
It was... Oh, so look, I'm such a fan of Ken. Introduce Ken. So Ken Robertson was, I believe his official title, we didn't talk about it actually, his official title was Head of Mischief at Paddy Power. Which kind of sets the tone for everything that he got up to with the team there. He's great. He's just done some of the best gambling industry marketing campaigns ever. So we talk about time with Paddy Power. We talk about his time with his new agency, the 10th Man, and all the kind of cool stuff that they're doing. And yeah, he's just somebody that, you know, the more you talk with him, just the more stories that come out of the stuff that they got up to and the things that they did. And
it is very, very rare that I meet somebody and I think, holy shit, this dude needs to write a book.
Very
but
much
Ken
so.
Robertson needs to write a book.
That's a good point.
And I'd offer to ghostwrite it for him, but he'd probably write it far better than me anyway. A guy can tell a story.
And we get to talk with Ken, and I talk about like the first time I met Ken and just how crazy it was, and yeah, it's good. I enjoyed it. It was good to catch up with him.
He's amazing, and he's just one of those crazy lives. You know, people like Ken should be paid to just think shit up. And it delights me that he is in a world where he has made that niche for himself. I think that's pretty special. I'm not jealous.
Oh, look, I'm very jealous. I'd love to be as smart as Ken is. That'd be fucking brilliant.
Yeah, there is that part of it. and smart and successful and, you know, respected for your work. Fuck. it is a genuinely really interesting conversation. What a geezer, frankly. Yeah. What a geezer. Interestingly, you didn't become more Irish in speaking to Ken.
Did I not?
Not really, no. I didn't notice any extra bigorras or anything like that in your speech.
I'd say bigorra. Jesus Christ.
Holy crap. A massive fly is flying around the microphone. So if anybody thinks I'm recording this on a motorbike, I'm not. That's the thing about summer, isn't it? Fucking flies come back.
Do you know what else comes back in summer?
Are you going to say IGB Live in Amsterdam for its final year?
I am.
That was another lucky guess.
Book your tickets. Get your hotel rooms.
Yeah.
Book your canal boats.
It's going to be a big one. Yeah, warm your clogs up. It's a thing. Bring your tulip vase.
Your clog wars.
I've actually got a vase just for tulips.
How is that even a thing?
I just saw it and I thought that'd be perfect for tulips, that would.
Oh, so you've just labeled it a tulip vase rather than it's like the special.
Oh, yeah. It's not like, you know, if you go on Amazon and search for tulip vase, you're not going to, it's not this subset that, you know, it's not like big vases version of Valentine's Day. It's like, we'll get those fucking tulip fans, we'll get them to buy an extra vase. Big vase's profits soar by up to 2%. No. It's just a vase that I use for tulips.
Nice.
I haven't bought any tulips for probably about 18 years or so. So I've got to say it has been somewhat underused.
Hasn't been fulfilling its purpose?
I haven't been fulfilling its purpose. It's not on the vase. It's like your classic resort fee, you know? Just because I didn't use the shoe shine or the fucking whatever else the resort fee's for, doesn't mean I couldn't have. It's been there waiting to be utilized. It's me letting the side down.
Do you know what else is also waiting there, waiting to be utilized?
I think the industry's leading CRM software.
I agree. I think people need to book a demo with Optimove. Link below.
That sounds like a great idea.
Clickety-click. CRM platform for the gambling industry, not just the gambling industry, for instance. But
I mean, it's super comprehensive. It's breathtakingly granular. I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible software.
Improve your retention, lower your costs, make more money. Go, go, go.
Basically, everything Fintan said. And Fintan, as regular listeners will know, is a very busy and important business person. So he knows things.
Fintan's having the worst sabbatical of his life.
But it's a compulsion with you. It's a compulsion.
It is a compulsion.
Jeez. Like, if I had a sabbatical, I'd probably get through all the books that I haven't been reading. It's about it. That's as far as I plan.
I have big plans, and now I'm just, you know, putting on weight, big bags under my eyes. Anyway.
Oh, that reminds me, I've got a plan. Need to tell you that.
Okay.
Talk about it off air, because it's...
All right. You know, millions of listeners.
Exactly.
Secrets. All right. Enjoy the episode again.
Ken Robertson. We're joined by our guest this week, because we're recording this last week as you're listening to it, for publishing next week, which is this week as you hear it. So for viewers listening in black and white, Fintan and I are joined by Ken Robertson, founder and CEO of The Tenth Man. Ken, welcome.
Thank you, John. Great to be on.
Well, you know, as we always like to say to our guests, let's not get ahead of ourselves because you might be regretting this in about 15 minutes. Now, Ken, you're a bit of a mystery guest to me because this is all Fintan's doing. Now, I'm just pleased that Fintan's here.
Yeah, I'm excited about this one. So I don't often get to fanboy out, but I'm a huge fan of Ken's. And I was joking with Ken earlier on. I was going to open with a story of like the first time I met Ken, and he'll be completely oblivious to it at this point. So many years ago, a long time ago, I was mere weeks into my Paddy Power career, doing the online marketing stuff, and hadn't really got a clue about online gambling or gambling in general. I'd like literally read like the bookie or the dummy's guide to betting, and you know, I'd started reading the Racing Post just to try and, you know, sound like I'd had a clue what was going on. And it was Barney Evans was the CMO at the time, and he dragged us all into a room, into this little war room, to plan out the Grand National. And Barney's kind of a force of nature, and he kind of ran this like it was intense, right? Everybody was standing up, and he was kind of just pointing around the room like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Kind of worked his way around. He got to Ken, and everyone had all these sensible plans. Or we'll do this, and we'll do this activation, blah, blah, blah. He got to Ken, and Ken's like, well, what I'm thinking is kind of shove a horse out of an airplane with a parachute, and we land the horse in the middle of Aintree, and it'll be a big branded parachute. And everybody just kind of goes, oh, that sounds like a great idea. I'm standing there going like, how the fuck does that even, like, who comes up with that idea? Like, where, how is this a thing? And then like meeting conclude, like I get pointed at, and I come up with a viral campaign. Because this was so long ago. It was when, like, for something to go viral, people had to email it to you. So people would like email each other like PowerPoint presentations or flash games. And I go, oh, you're digital, you do a flash game. Off we got sent. And then obviously leading up to the Grand National, I'm not sure what happened, Ken, in terms of like animal rights and finding a horse that could fly or whatever, but you ended up, you had a jockey, I think, do a parachute jump into the middle of the race course.
You know what, Fintan, I mean, there's been so many kind of Paddy Power moments, I literally cannot remember that one. I'm pretty sure we didn't parachute a horse onto Aintree, though, for a number of very good reasons. I do faintly recollect jockeys jumping out of a plane and potentially having the trophy of the race on them or strapped on them, and they then presented a trophy to the winning connection. So that rings a bell. But right, that's probably 15 years ago.
That's the thing. So what I love is Ken has done so much in the meantime. The parachuting jockey, like typically like parachuting a jockey into the race course would be like bullet point, like top three bullet points on somebody's CV. But for Ken, it's like, yeah, I probably did that. And it was such a great example of like coming up with ideas. Okay, like we got this crazy idea, and then, okay, reality is we can't make it a horse, but we can move along those same lines. We can have as much impact with a jockey, not break any laws, and still hit the same impact. And for me, in fairness, it was also like how Barney ran that meeting. I learned more about the marketing in that one meeting in my first few weeks than probably anything else I've ever done. It was a phenomenal kind of Thunderdome moment of like, oh shit, like I'm completely out of my depth here. These guys are amazing. So yeah, that was the first time I met Ken properly, or heard Ken speak or something like that. And I suppose, so which was kind of what I wanted to dig into a little bit. So if you take that kind of, and like obviously Paddy Power is famous for it. There was the Paddy Power kind of strategy for marketing and creating a buzz and stuff. And then if you look at kind of what you're doing now with your current, the 10th man and stuff, and I think there's obviously a common thread, but creativity as a process creativity isn't just like, well, sometimes it is that eureka moment, but there's also a process for creativity. What was that process? Like you've one of these crazy ideas, oh, we need to do X, or we're going to do Y. What was the behind the scenes of like how that, was there a, was it very systematic, or was it more fluid and it's just a WhatsApp group and just a couple of lads bouncing ideas, or going, because I think going from idea to making something reality, there's a huge amount there that nobody really sees. So what's that like?
Look, to be totally honest, Fintan, I think you're giving us all a little bit more credit than we were due. Like there was no framework for creativity back then. I suppose the mantra back in, you know, the halcyon days of Paddy Power marketing, so the kind of noughties and into the teens, was very much driven by, you know, the first big brand campaign that we had, which was, I think was in 2000, the year 2000. I had started a previous year. We had just launched paddypower.com. We had just entered the UK market. So we engaged a big London agency called BBH, Bartle, Bogle, Hegarty, and we got them to create our first brand campaign, which I don't know if you remember, it was kind of two grannies crossing a zebra crossing, and yeah, there was like this big 4x4 kind of bearing down on them, and there was odds over each granny's head, evens 2-1. And of course, you know, we argued, we were simply, you know, betting on which granny would cross the road first, but it was obvious it was which one would be run over. But Bartle, Bogle, Hegarty, BBH were just coming off the back of the a big Levi's campaign with Flat Eric, and you know, their mantra for Levi's was quite simple, a really kind of articulate line: when the world zigs, you zag. And that was something that just felt super relevant for Paddy Power as well, as we were kind of navigating our course in what was a very homogenous, very vanilla category, where back then, I know it's changed now, but you know, every bookmaker was essentially selling the same stuff, right? It was impossible to kind of differentiate on price. You could within kind of very narrow margins, but the real kind of genius of Paddy Power's success was one of the co-founders, a guy called Stuart Kenny, really embraced this idea of, he didn't want Paddy Power to be another gambling company. He wanted it to be an entertainment company. So, you know, that sounds a little bit trite now, but actually back then, this was visionary. This was so, so different to everything else that was out there at the time. So using that as our kind of North Star, we embraced that and we brought it into every kind of marketing meeting that we were in. Obviously, you had a taste of the Grand National one that particular year, which was probably around 2008, 2009. But, you know, there was no framework as such for creativity, but we all always followed a North Star of, you know, we don't see ourselves as just another betting operator, you know. And the kind of litmus test was, whatever idea we come up with, we'd ask ourselves, would Ladbrokes do this? Would Bet365 do this? Would William Hill do this? Would Betfair do this? And if the answer was yes to any one of those, the idea was thrown out and we'd start again.
I love that. But it was, I think for me as well, what was really refreshing was, like, you talked about like entering the UK market and stuff. And as an Irish company, that's a really big deal, because there's so many Irish companies that are big in Ireland, but aren't outside of Ireland. And there's a few, Paddy Power is an exception, Ryanair is probably the other exception, and a couple of others. But particularly back then, to have the ambition and just the, you know, just the attitude of, oh, we're just going to go into the UK market and just take market share from all these guys. That was a huge, I think there was a mentality at Paddy Power at the time as well that was quite refreshing and unique, and I hadn't really seen elsewhere. Where were you before you joined Power? Like, what was the jump for you into Paddy Power?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I started in Paddy's in 1999, giving away my age here a bit, but I was the first ever marketing hire brought into the business. At that time, I think it was a chain of around 100 high street betting shops just operating in the Republic of Ireland. Before that, I was a couple of years at a uni. I was working for a video rental company called Extravision. I don't know if you remember them.
Sure, yeah.
Kind of what people had to do before Netflix was a thing. So it was a chain of video and DVD libraries that you go down, you pay £3 or £4, and you'd rent essentially a movie, bring it home, and drop it back the next day. So I was essentially a marketing intern there for a couple of years. And on the board of directors for Extravision was Stuart Kenny, the co-founder of Paddy Power. And to be fair to Stuart and the guys in Paddy's, they realized that this new internet thing was potentially going to be a game changer for what they did for betting. So they kind of rolled the dice and they invested in what became PaddyPower.com. Now, you've got to remember, this was at a time when no broadband, dial-up connections, maybe ISDN if you were lucky, right? So PaddyPower.com was essentially the first ever online sports betting site, launched in June 2000. I was brought in because they needed some support in terms of marketing for this new thing that at the time nobody knew if it would work, by the way. Like Stuart's logic for investing whatever they invested in PaddyPower.com was there's this, you know, outfit in the US called Amazon, and they're selling a shitload of books, and, you know, why don't we do what they do for betting, and we don't have to buy like shipping anything, because essentially, you know, we're just selling, you know, an intangible product. It's a service. So got that up and running in June 2000, and look, that clearly did quite well for itself. And so I started. I was marketing hire number one. When I left 18 years later, like you know as well as me, I think there was around 550 people in the marketing team.
I'm not surprised.
Huge. Bigger than most kind of network kind of ad agencies. So an extraordinary journey to be on. But look, I suppose two things. One you already mentioned was just that kind of willingness to carve our own path. But from the very, very get-go, as I've just illustrated and what I said, there was always a huge spirit of innovation in the business. So being able to spot the opportunity in online for sports betting back essentially in the late 90s when, you know, I think, you know, dial-up penetration was around 25% in Ireland at the time. That was such an incredibly, you know, wise move back then. Fortune favors the brave in a way. So bringing together a spirit of innovation and this spirit of disruption, which was very much kind of driven by Stuart Kenny at the time, was very much the platform for success for everything that was to follow in Paddy's and Flutter and whatever it's called these days.
It's like when you think about that kind of bet, and now, you know, you look at, say, the Flutter Group, and
it's
basically the biggest online gambling company in the world.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. And when it started, Fintan, we were up in a small kind of a small business park in the middle of Talla called Talla Village Green. And we had two offices because PaddyPower.com was 6 months in operation at this time. So we had to take an overflow office. And there was a hard wire essentially running from the server, which was in the old head office building, over to the new room where all the online people were. Cormac Barry, I think, had just started at that time. So this was 2001 or so. And I remember it was the first Christmas that PaddyPower.com was kind of in operation. I think we had around 5,000 customers. We couldn't believe our luck. And then it was, I think it was coming up to Christmas. It was early December. And one day, just everything stopped. PaddyPower.com just shut down. The whole thing stopped. And nobody could figure out what was wrong. And there was all sorts of panic emerging across both offices. But it turned out what had happened was in between the two offices was a spa shop in Talla. And the owner of the spa shop had basically put up his giant neon Santa on top of the spar and had essentially ripped out PaddyPower.com to plug in his Santa. And PaddyPower.com was essentially offline for like a 72-hour period until we realized that, the big glow-in-the-dark Santa is taking us down.
Someone go get a splitters.
Exactly. But that's where it started. That was ground zero. That was year one.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. And then obviously there's been so many, so if we focus on the marketing side of things, there's been so many campaigns, so many like talking moments, like the blind football team or they, it sounds like they've kicked the cat or something like that. And there's been so many of these kind of campaigns, but my the one that I always remember was I was working at when I was working for Google, I'd flown over to San Francisco to meet the YouTube team, and I was going to make a big pitch around I was meeting a bunch of policy teams. I was going to make a big pitch about like changing gambling policies, letting UK gambling companies use more of the Google tools and these kind of things. And I'm in the hotel room, flick on the news, and I swear to God, Dennis Rodman walks out to do a press conference with the Paddy Power background, and it's made CNN in America. And I'm like a couple of hours before this meeting, and I'm sitting there going, oh Jesus Christ, they're never going to sign off on anything. I've completely wasted this trip. there's no chance. They're super serious companies. They take things very responsible. There'll be no controversy. There'll be no PR blowback. And, you know, there's Kim Jong-un and Dennis Rodman, Paddy Power merch or whatever he was wearing, or whatever he was doing. So tell me about the North Korean campaign and what happened.
That had quite a long tail on it. So that started in a very unlikely circumstance of the first Pope resigning in, I think, was it 800 years? So correct me if I'm wrong, it feels like this was probably 2013, 2014. Mm. And Paddy and myself had a bit of form when a Pope either died or in this case resigned. We would fly over at St. Peter's Square with a bookies pitch and start taking bets on the next Pope. And the reason we did this is there's a process called conclave, a very secretive process where every Vatican from every parish around the world descends on St. Peter's Square. They go into the Sistine Chapel and they're essentially locked away and they don't come out until they elect a new Pope. Now, this could be a matter of hours or it could be a matter of days. In some cases, it could be a matter of weeks. But what you do have is the world's media assembled in St. Peter's Square with absolutely nothing to report on, apart from these two fucking idiot Irish bookies shouting the odds in terms of market movers, whether it's, you know, a market plunge on the, you know, Cardinal Francois Rinze from Nigeria or what. So we were essentially creating content for a new starved international media corp. And they absolutely loved it. So we did this when John Paul II died back in 2007.
Mm.
And it was a slam dunk. We were literally in every media organization across the world. We were on the front page of the New York Times. We had our own slot on CNN, a daily slot, people betting updates. And Sky News had us on. So 2007 was just like a PR dream, right? Again, just pushing the Paddy Power brand out there in the international stage. So when Pope Ratzinger, it was Ratzinger, wasn't he? Yeah, it was Ratzinger. When he decided he was going to resign, you know, it was an easy decision to dispatch Paddy back over. For some reason, I didn't go, but I think we wanted to give somebody else a turn. So we gave a guy called Rory Scott, who was our head of UK PR. We sent him and Paddy over. And they just followed the blueprint of what we had done back in 2007. They were shouting the odds. I remember tuning in. Sorry, this is a very kind of long version of the answer. I'll try and speed it up. But I was watching Sky News to see Paddy and Rory. They were due to do a slot on the latest kind of market movers live from St. Peter's Square. And the story before that was Dennis Rodman with the Harlem Globetrotters performing an exhibition match in Pyongyang. And I just found this very, very curious. And then literally the next news story was Paddy and Rory shouting the odds in Vatican City. We had, this is where stuff gets a bit weird, we had a money back special in typical Paddy Power fashion on our papal betting that year, because the two favorites in the betting market were both African, were both black. So there was Francois Arinze from Nigeria and Cardinal Turkson from Ghana. So it looked very likely, it looked actually odds on, we were going to have the first ever black pope. And we came up with this money back special to celebrate the first ever black pope in the Catholic Church, that we'd refund money on all the losers. So the headline was "Money Back If He's Black." Catchy, right? We were thinking of ways to promote this. So I was like, literally, there was a map of the world on the wall in the marketing office in Paddy Power. So I had a look at North Korea, and I knew Robin was flying back to New York, as he had said it in the interview. And literally, if you put a pin halfway between Pyongyang and New York, it's Rome. So I reached out, just didn't think anything would come from it, but I reached out to Robin's agent, just quick Google search, and very interesting guy. Came back to me within 10 minutes, and, you know, the conversation was how much. So anyway, we did a deal very hastily. 24 hours later, Rodman touches down in Rome wearing a T-shirt with Paddy Power branding saying "Money back if he's black." So we got him picked up in a makeshift Pope mobile and drove him around St. Peter's Square in this kind of press stunt for Paddy Power promoting our money back special if the Pope is black. Again, slam dunk. Fast forward to that night, conversation is over dinner where Rodman was, you know, how did you get on? Did you tell us about North Korea? And he was like, hey, man, you know, it was, you know, the colonel, as he called him, Kim Jong-un. He was like, yeah, he thought it was a load of shit. He thought the Harlem Globetrotters were just like some variety act. And we were like, okay, so what do you want to do? And he goes, I want to do it for fucking real, man. I want to bring some NBA players over and have a real basketball match. So that's where the idea came from. And we kind of said, okay, well, we can possibly help you to achieve this. And then over the process of the next couple of months, we put in place what was going to be a American team versus a North Korean team, being held the following February on Kim Jong-un's 30th birthday. Now, there was a little bit of precedence for this. If you go back to the late 60s, there was what was called ping pong politics or ping pong diplomacy, when an American team went over to China to play ping pong. And this was a time of great animosity between, you know, China and North America. And this kind of ping pong match actually kind of thawed that relationship a little bit and got them talking. So we developed this initiative called Basketball Diplomacy. So with the help of, with Rodman as the figurehead of all of this, we worked on putting together an NBA kind of all-star team of former players. Big press conference to launch it in New York. Then everything was looking good. There was a couple of trips over to Pyongyang to get everything set up. We ran into a wobble around a month before the game was due to be played, because of what became known as the purge, where Kim Jong-un got very unhappy with his government cabinet at the time, which was headed up by his uncle, I believe. And depending on who you want to believe, he was either fed to 20 hungry wolves, was beheaded in the middle of Pyongyang, or was tied to a pole and shot by several people. And this went on for several weeks. The UN took a very dim view of an Irish bookmaker promoting an international sporting event in Pyongyang against the backdrop of all this geopolitical unrest. We start getting a lot of heat from international media organizations taking a very dim view on, you know, why we are engaging in this at this particular time. So to cut a long story short, we pulled the plug in terms of our title sponsorship around 2 weeks before the match was due to be played. But the match went ahead. We just took our name off the jerseys, but all the funding was still in place and the match happened. And actually it seemed to be quite a success. So that's the long version of it. Short story.
So
Hang on. I'm just really sorry. I've just got to chip in here. There's a lot there, right? And there's one thing I want to give you and one thing I need to learn from you here. The thing I want to give you is an idea that I had a long time ago, and it's come up in this podcast before, of how crematoriums could sex things up a bit. And it was like the convocation, it made me think of that. That what they should do is they should do either white smoke or black smoke as to whether the person was going to heaven or hell.
Nice.
Because they kick you out so quickly that you see the smoke. And it just, you know, people are outside, they're having a cigarette or whatever, and it just makes it a little bit more interesting.
Well, and you can do that. Have you ever done the bonfires where you put like the packet stuff you can buy that does like sparkles and all these kind of things? You can make a whole thing out of the smoke.
There is a lot of possibilities there. My dear friend and mother of my children, Fern, we were looking up at the smoke, and I said my idea, and she's like, "That's a really good idea." She said, "But at yours, if it's white smoke, everybody's going to say, oh, but he's not going to know anybody there." The other thing, and this was unbelievably the standout from the Dennis Rodman story for me, fucking makeshift Pope Mobile.
I know.
Whoa.
That actually came from a stunt that we had conducted around 2 years earlier when the Pope visited England.
We had it in the garage.
As a bit of subterfuge, we knew the route the Pope was going. In fact, he was traveling down, I think, from Glasgow to London in this Pope Mobile. So we got a replica Pope Mobile with a lookalike Pope, and we sent him out like 2 hours ahead of when he was scheduled to do it, just so we beat the police cordon and the security. Just really did it for shits and giggles, to be honest. But we filled
that. That is lucky, though.
Yeah, we filled a lot of we filled a lot of people, but we also filled a lot of media as well. That actually took a photograph and ran the story with the Paddy Power Pope Mobile instead of the real one. So we had that essentially on ice for a couple of years. Didn't know what to do. It was in the car park of the Klonsky office.
Was it? Did somebody have to drive it to Vatican City then?
Yeah. So
what a trip! What a road trip that must have been.
All this had to happen within 24 hours. So boat to Holyhead, through the Channel Tunnel. Then I remember it broke down going over the Alps and there was panic stations. But we managed to get it going and it literally landed or it arrived into Da Vinci Airport in Rome around an hour before Robin landed from North Korea.
It's like a comedy movie where like the two interns have got to drive the Pope Mobile to Vatican City before Dennis Rodman lands. Right, yeah. Or whoever, and like, oh, we broke down in the Alps, and then this happened.
Fenton, you missed a key ingredient out. They've got a Pope lookalike with them who dies, and they've got to convince everybody that he's the real Pope and is alive. Weekend at the Vatican.
well, funny you mentioned movies, because there was a movie that came out, and it was absolutely based on Robin and the whole Paddy Power thing in North Korea. It came out a couple of years after we did it. Seth Rogen was it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It got banned.
James Franco.
Yeah. That's right. And I think, it ran into trouble, didn't it, to North Korea?
They had problems. It wasn't just obviously problems in North Korea, but there was some issue.
I'll tell you what it was. Sony was the distributor, and they ended up taking down Sony's website for a couple of days. But
they hacked Sony. That's right. There was a whole thing. Yeah,
absolutely. But that movie absolutely 100% took the whole Robin Paddy Power thing as its kind of catalyst, no doubt. Because there was a couple of characters in the kind of the whole North Korean thing that you see replicated in the movie.
That's hilarious. And you didn't even get a writing credit. Outrageous.
Absolutely nothing. Certainly didn't get the royalties anyway.
That too. When the heat comes in, so when you, because obviously there's been a lot of campaigns that have been, they've been perceived to cross a line, or it's offended somebody. And a lot of times that's deliberate, or, you know, it's part of the deal. But there can be times where there's a lot of backlash, where it's like, this is a really big deal. The one that springs to mind, so there's a couple. So the one that springs to mind is where, say, I think it was with Obama, there was like betting, will Obama, there was a lot of impeachment of Obama talk.
Yeah.
And it was like betting on second term, first term, second term. But that got spun as betting on an assassination type thing. So you kind of go out with one kind of market, but it gets extrapolated into, oh, you're taking bets on somebody killing Obama, which is clearly awful and I don't think was intended. And then there's other ones where it's maybe, you know, say Oscar Pistorius. I can't remember exactly what the market was, but it was something around Oscar, which was a big one too. I suppose how, like, pre-doing one of these, what's the thought process behind it? And then when the heat comes in, when you guys realize like, oh shit, actually, this is a big deal. What's it like? Because for most companies, they would just like never do. They do one of these, it blows up or something goes wrong, and then there's, that's it. We're never doing that again. How do what makes Paddy Power different, or what made it different at the time?
I suppose again, you rewind the clock back to the likes of Stuart Kenny, who was one of the co-founders, and you know he was all about Paddy Power being the anti-establishment brand, being the brand that gives kind of two fingers to the PC brigade. So that was part of the DNA from the very, very get-go. So when you have that essentially as your kind of, you know, founder mandated North Star, that gives you a huge amount of latitude. You're also, you know, operating against a backdrop of a very safe, samey category. You know, as you know, both of you well know, you know, sports betting is about essentially how you manage risk. So an awful lot of the operators take a very risk-averse approach to everything they do in the business, marketing, advertising, promotions included. But Stuart Kenny, he was the guy that booked that trend, and in doing so, just gave ourselves a huge amount of clear water to play in. You know, it became obvious over time that Paddy Power was the brand that would say what kind of young men thought themselves, but were too afraid to say. So we kind of became a proxy for what people thought in a way, and very much played into that slightly kind of, I guess, you know, edgy slash controversial space. So, over the years, you operate in a very kind of interesting space when you are promoting the Paddy Power brand. Well, certainly when I was there, I can't speak for it now, I'm out of there 7 or 8 years, but you were always kind of treading on a razor blade a little bit in terms of, you know, you always wanted to provoke, but in a kind of fun and cheeky kind of way. You never wanted to deliberately go out or punch down or hurt people. That wasn't what the brand was about, but it was about, you know, generating earned media coverage and keeping Paddy Power top of mind and promoting this kind of, you know, challenger brand that it really kind of, you know, wrapped itself into over the years. So, you know, with the exception, I suppose, of the U-turn on the North Korean thing, which was extraordinarily unique in as much as, you know, the UN were involved. Like, it was literally dangerous for our people to go over there. When we pulled the plug on it, we actually had one of our people, Rory, the guy I mentioned earlier, was still in Pyongyang, and we were genuinely worried for the guy's, you know, safety.
He must have had a great review that year. Like, you know, put his life on the line, stayed in Pyongyang, wrote it out.
But over the years, you know, it's in equal measure, we kind of managed to kind of piss off everybody from the Catholic Church to pet lovers, the trans community, visually impaired people, Irish people, English people, OAPs. Even the Westboro Baptist Church got really pissed off at that one point.
Why? What happened with them?
Because we came up with a campaign called Rainbow Laces.
That was great.
Which was really cool.
Yeah, I love that campaign.
So you know, people think of Paddy Power and it's always a kind of crazy, kind of controversy, courty campaigns. But Rainbow Lace was a fantastic campaign. We partnered with the Premier League. The premise was, you know, you've got whatever 200 professional footballers in the Premier League and not one of them is openly gay. Well, that doesn't really compute. So, you know, why is there nobody gay in professional football? Oh, because, you know, professional footballers don't want to come out as gay because it's, you know, a little bit destructive for their career. So we launched a campaign called Rainbow Laces, where we sent out these rainbow colored boot laces to all the clubs in the English league and non-league clubs and just encouraged them to wear them on one particular weekend. That kind of coincided with Pride, and it was just massively embraced by everybody. Gary Lineker wore them on Match of the Day. It was just a big success and really kind of moved the needle in terms of awareness of homophobia in football, and our campaign was set up to try and stamp it out. Well, unsurprisingly, the Westboro Baptist Church took a very dim view of us trying to further the plight of gay footballers, and we got some pretty obnoxious correspondence from them.
That must be a point of pride though, right? You frame it, put it on the wall. That's mission unlocked. That's mission achieved. Really what you're saying then is with things like controversy or pushback from ASA or whatever the body is, it really needs the mandate from the top to be able to, so the PR team or the marketing team aren't kind of hung out to dry. Kind of a, look, we're all in this together and we'll do that. The next question then will be kind of following on from that, then will be things. So obviously, you know, you talk about top of mind, earned media coverage and kind of getting the brand out there. Because obviously Paddy Power is also very data driven. What was the kind of the KPI, what does KPIs look like for that? Or what does success, how does success ultimately get measured? Is it like what were they tracking over time to kind of go, okay, we need to keep doing this, it's working?
One part of me would say the real KPIs that interested me were essentially the number of complaints that we get and the level of earned media coverage that it would generate, and the two were far from mutually exclusive. And the playbook was you try and piss off a very small percentage of people, right? And it was important that these are, you know, non-sports betting people. So you'd rub them up the wrong way, and then they would be the very people that would then give you the kind of oxygen and publicity in the media. So, you know, we go back to the granny's ad, two old deers crossing a road, odds over their head. Are we betting on, do they cross the road first, do they get run over first? And then a small cohort of very, you know, very annoyed people getting annoyed on behalf of the OAPs would, you know, drum up an absolute media frenzy, which has the effect of just elongating the kind of detail of the campaign far further than it would have been if there was no controversy in the first place. So we learned this kind of at a very early stage. And then the real opportunity is, how do you almost weaponize this in a way? And how do you, you know, pick off these small kind of cohorts of people that, you know, by doing this, this will kind of generate this particular effect. And again, it's, you know, it really is kind of on the razor blade of marketing, because if you get it wrong, it's not pretty. But the real skill is knowing how close to kind of tread on.
So what's this? So like the Pistorius one broke a lot of records, right? That, from, in terms of complaints, wasn't that like?
Biggest ever, or something. It remains the most complained about ad in British advertising history by a multiple of three. And that was due to its headline, Money Back If He Walks.
It still gets me. I love a good headline. Yeah, I can see why people complain. But yeah, so obviously it's, you know, a woman got killed or murdered, you know, it's pretty like, that's like, is that on the, I know I laugh, which probably doesn't help, but like you could see why it would generate more complaints and kind of maybe be just the, you know, beyond the pale kind of thing.
Yeah. I suppose maybe what you're missing there is context. So, and I feel like I'm justifying this. I don't mean to, but the context was, this was back in 2014. And this trial was huge news. There was essentially a 24-hour news station just reporting on it right through the course of the trial. Like, it was literally their biggest thing on the international global news agenda for that period of time that the trial went on. You know, everybody had dedicated crews out in South Africa covering it live. So, you know, Paddy Power's kind of model at the time was, if it's newsworthy and it's in kind of popular conversation, whether that's at water coolers in offices or people talking about it over a pint at the bar, then people should be allowed betting it. And it was no different to before I was there back in the early 90s. You know, we were betting on the O.J. Simpson trial. Mm. Before that, we were betting on, you know, who killed J.R. in Dallas. So it was all these hyper topical cultural moments or news agenda driven moments that, you know, if people are talking about it in sufficient numbers, that people should be allowed betting the outcome. And that was the rationale for the Pistorius trial. And the ad was purely a vehicle to promote the fact that, you know, we were betting on a guilty or not guilty verdict.
Got it. But 3x the complaints of anything that's ever gone before it is,
yeah,
like that's a good metric. That's really well done. That's really well done. Okay, so we've reminisced about Paddy Power. And I'm guessing you decided one day, right, I'm gonna go do some other stuff. And now you've how many, I can't remember, 7 or 8 years you've done the tent, man?
Yeah, so I left Paddy's shortly after the Pistorius ad. I was exiled down to Melbourne for a year to serve my time. So I was reunited with Barney Evans, actually, who was
he's running it, yeah.
CMO of Sportsbet at the time. So I worked with him. And served out my jail sentence for 12 months down in Melbourne, which is as good a place to serve out punishment as you could imagine. It's
phenomenal. Better than it used to be anyway.
Yeah. And came back up in 2016. And yeah, I just lost a grow for it, Fintan, to be honest. You know, the company had, even in that short period of 12 months, it had changed a lot. It had grown up a lot. It had become a lot more corporate than it had been, for very good reasons. A lot of the stunts and marketing initiatives that we had have done over the previous 15 years just weren't really an option anymore. And the merger with Betfair happened, which, you know, again, just changed the dynamic of the business, certainly the dynamic of the culture. I didn't feel it anymore. It was my time to go. And when you know, you know. And it was funny, when I got back from Australia, I the kind of writing was on the door when our head of legal moved into the office beside me, and his legal secretary moved into the office on the other side of me. So I was kind of like, the jig is up.
Fair enough. It's definitely a signal.
Yeah, I literally couldn't go to the fucking toilet without a lawyer crawling around the building. So that was 2017. Broke the news, and to be honest, they were brilliant about it. They were really, really good, and they were very supportive. Probably fucking delighted to see the
back. Relieved. It's cheaper than sacking you.
But you know, during the course of the 18 years, which was just a phenomenal journey, man, it was the best gig anybody could have. It was my first kind of proper real job, and it was 18 years. It kind of felt like 18 months, but along the way, I had built up a reputation of being good on that kind of disruptive side of marketing myself. And during the kind of last couple of years in Paddy Power, I've been asked to do plenty of talks at conferences and marketing events and speak about how to build a challenger brand, you know, disruptive side of marketing, all this type of thing. So when I left, I decided I put it to the test. And really my ambition back then was just going out and consulting for maybe 6 or 12 months, look to build up a portfolio of brands or businesses. So I wanted to kind of flex in that slightly more disruptive side of the marketing spectrum. But within a couple of months, I got absolutely slammed with work from really good clients. Virgin Bet were one of the first. And there was around 5 or 6 other clients came in month one. So very quickly, I kind of realized I had no problem bringing work in, but I had every problem getting the work done. So scaled my ambition from just me as a consultant to, you know what, there is actually a proper viable business in this. So just started adding people as needed to support me in doing what I was trying to do, and very much just let the mix of clients that we had in that first year kind of define the type of agency we've become. And so set up an agency called The 10th Man, based out of Dublin. Year one, I think we had 10, year two, 20, year three, COVID, we stood still. But with the exception of COVID, there's kind of been a doubling in terms of the size of the business since we got going, in terms of headcount, in terms of turnover, in terms of client base. We're up to 50 at the moment, headquartered in Dublin. Feels like we've kind of hit a ceiling in terms of what Dublin can offer us in terms of growth. Mm. Like I said, we've enjoyed strong double-digit growth every year since we got going, with the exception of COVID, and feels like we're kind of topping out in terms of Dublin now. So based on that, we've recently opened an office in Farringdon in London, appointed an MD, and we're kind of scaling a London team at the moment to help support kind of future growth of the business.
That makes a lot of sense. I think London's obvious. Have you considered the US?
Yeah.
You've done a little bit in the US. You've done some campaigns in the US.
We have. So, we have a kind of, way to put it, a disproportionate skew of clients in, you know, regulated markets. So we're currently working with Diageo on Guinness, Carlsberg, Pernod Ricard on Jameson Whiskey. And sports betting, we're creative partner to Fanatics in the US,
nice.
PointsBet in Australia, and SuperBet in East Europe. And we're also exploring kind of some interesting opportunities in the retail cannabis space in Germany and Holland. So we do a lot in regulated markets and everything that comes with that, from an advertising, you know, marketing, general comms point of view.
Mm. That's interesting.
Fenton?
Yeah.
Did I ever tell you my story about Farringdon Tube Station?
No, you haven't told me your story about Farringdon Tube Station.
It's pretty grim.
Is it?
Really is. But Ken, you've inspired me. So, but Farringdon, for those not who don't know that part of London, Farringdon is pretty posh, isn't it? And there's a lot of creative businesses around there, a lot of finance businesses around there, and a lot of very, very rich people. And I was doing some work at one of the movie studios by St. Albans. I can't remember which one it is. One with a big soundstage, huge soundstage where The Shining was filmed. Anyway, I was doing some work out there. And I was traveling back into London on the train down to Farringdon Tube. And I just had these awful stomach cramps out of nowhere. And I'm like, oh, God, this is, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. And they were just coming in waves. And I thought, I think today might be the day that I poo my pants in public. I don't think I'm going to have a lot of choice about this. It was really incredibly painful and just like, oh, God. And I managed to hang on to Farringdon Tube, right? Get to Farringdon Tube station. And it's a Victorian station. It's a really old station. And the facilities are also really old. And I find the toilet and I get into the toilet and it's basically two very close together urinals and a single cubicle, which is occupied. And I'm like, oh, no. Well, okay, today's not going to be the day that I poo my pants in public, but today might be the day that I do a poo in a sink. And then luckily, the toilet flushed. And this bloke comes out, and I'm like, thanks. And I go in, and the relief was just, I had been absolutely doubled up in pain. And, I got in there, and I thought, oh, no, I didn't check if there were... And there was toilet paper and everything. So I'm like, oh, what a blessed day.
It's better than a lottery win, that. That's great.
Anyway, so I'm sitting there and I'm waiting for everything to run its course. And I'm just so relieved. So relieved. And then these two, I can only describe them as finance types, and I'm only going by their voices. These two very, very well-spoken gentlemen walk in and go to the urinals. And one of them just turns to the other and says, I say, it smells like somebody's had a rat for breakfast. And whenever anybody says Farringdon now, that's where I go to in my head. Sorry. That's why I'm here. So the 10th man, we talked before we started recording about why it was called the 10th man.
Okay. It's from a fucking zombie movie.
Not The Art of War now.
From World War Z.
Did you
just do the movie or did you read the book?
I didn't read a book. I just did a movie. I did a movie twice, actually. I thought it was great. I'm a big zombie movie fan in general. So that was awesome. I think there's like a part two coming out soon.
I don't know. I mean, I love a good zombie movie myself.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I'd describe World War Z as a good zombie movie, but the one thing they did that was really effective was somehow they made a global zombie movie with no blood in it.
Yeah,
that blew my mind. There's even an amputation in it and there's no blood. It's bonkers. But it was, you know, it was fun. I enjoyed it.
It was fun.
But seriously, read the book. The book is absolutely fantastic. Genuinely. And I've read the author's other books and they're shite. Yeah. So I think it's one of those where he had one really good idea, executed it. You know, you should have done a Harper Lee at that point and just left the rest.
I know.
I mean, he's Mel Brooks' son. It's not like he has to work.
Yeah. I hear you.
The tenth man idea in the book and the movie and presumably in some battle philosophy that Fintan's read is the idea that you have nine people. Say you have a council of 10 people around a table, nine of them agree, one of them has the task of being a contrarian and questioning everything and preparing for what may seem a ridiculous eventuality.
Exactly right. And look, I mean, parking zombie movies for a moment, I was looking for a name that kind of leaned in a bit to the Paddy Power backstory. And like you said, Fintan, the URL was available.
It's key. It's key in all marketing decisions, frankly.
Or affordable.
So I suppose, John, maybe just to build on your exclamation at 10th man, I mean, it is a tactic to avoid the pitfalls of groupthink, right? So it's taking this strategy at a military and applying it to business. And groupthink, no matter what client we work with or what category, or even in Paddy Power to a degree, it's a real challenge in a business. You know, people come into a boardroom, they're brainstorming ideas. Generally, one voice kind of dictates exactly where it's going to go. If that voice generally is a senior leader in the business, there's very few people brave enough to put their hand up and challenge the kind of, you know, I guess the authority of that one person. So this is a framework that, you know, we embrace, we bring to our clients, we share this as a kind of methodology that we will deliberately provoke them in a positive kind of way.
The one I loved recently was the NECAP. So for those that are not familiar, it's a Northern Ireland rap trio. And it's a mixture of English and Irish that they rap in. And the RUC Land Rover spray painted with the smoke flares at Sundance was just perfect. That was just like for the promo video where the lads were in Provo and they called the Uber, and it was just phenomenal. But it got picked up by Sony.
It did. The movie. Yeah. So we've been working with the NECAP guys who, like you say, Fintan, it's an Irish kind of rap outfit from Belfast who, you know, uniquely rap Oscalga. So they rap in Irish. And we've shot a couple of music videos for them over the past couple of years. And then, we found out they had made this film with randomly Michael Fassbender. And it was going to get its kind of world premiere in Sundance last January or February, I'm not sure. So they asked for our help to come up with a marketing kind of PR stunt to help amplify, you know, the movie actually over at Sundance. So, yeah, we came up with the idea of delivering the lads to the premiere in an RUC Land Rover, which was a kind of doctored prop Land Rover that we managed to get. And someone
that you had left over from...
Was it a Popemobile?
It was not a repurposed Popemobile. You have my word on that.
Really got your money's worth out of that Popemobile.
Yeah, but again, look, this was a small, low-budget Irish movie in Sundance up against, you know, some of Hollywood's finest. And with this stunt, it just got a lot of eyeballs on them. And it is a fantastic movie. I saw a version of it a couple of months ago. But the stunt generated a huge amount of publicity for them. And the movie was the first movie to be bought at Sundance this year. It was picked up by Sony. And it also won the kind of prestigious audience award at the end of the festival. So,
I saw the BBC article or the BBC news article about them getting rejected for some sort of grant, and I'm like, that's got Ken's fingerprints all over it. Giggles.
The Daily Mail, of course, went to town over the fact that, you know, British taxpayers' money was being used to fund this, you know, Belfast. I can't remember exactly what they called it, but it was
perfect. It was perfect. That's what it was. Brilliant. Yeah, that was fantastic. So okay, so it's you've opened, and I saw you've hired so you've opened the London office. You've got Gethin in London, who's phenomenal, heading that up. I'm expecting big things coming out of the UK, and it'll be phenomenal. Really well done. Congrats.
Thank you. That's very kind. Very excited by, I guess how the 10th man can turn up in London. I mean, you know, we have been working with international clients on and off over the last 5 years, but I think actually having a physical base there,
it helps. Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, really, really excited to see where we can go.
Brilliant. Okay.
Just one last tiny thing. What's your favorite zombie movie?
Oh God, yeah, that's a good one. It's I'm tempted to go back to like George A. Romero stuff here, but I mean, that sounds a bit wanky, doesn't it? Well,
no.
What was the Cillian Murphy one? The
28 Days Later.
28 Days Later. Yeah, that was the first one. I didn't really like the second one. I thought that one was really good.
A lot of purists say not a zombie movie because they're not actually dead. But it's got the principles of a zombie movie. So, but 28 Weeks Later, while it was nowhere near as good, the opening 5 minutes of 28 Weeks Later is phenomenal.
Yeah, it really is, actually. So good.
And you know, that lives long in the memory. But 28 Days Later, it's like two movies in one. And,
yeah.
And the first half of the movie, I think, is exceptionally good. And the second half of the movie, it does stumble quite a bit. But it's still fun.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, that opening sequence, the first 15 minutes when he wakes up in hospital and he doesn't know what the fuck is going on.
Yeah, it's beautifully done.
Yeah, so good. So good.
But you can't diss George Romero. I mean, you can, don't get me wrong, because he made some terrible films.
Yeah.
But the first three.
Yeah.
I think Dawn of the Dead is like the second best horror movie of any kind ever made, personally.
I'd agree, and Sam Raimi, of course, needs to get an honourable mention.
He's my hero.
He is great. He is
the innovation, the creativity, the passion in his early movies. Well, not just in his early movies, but I mean his later stuff's.
I only rewatched Evil Dead. Well, it's probably around 12 months ago now, but just fucking so good. What a good movie.
Yeah, it's a stunningly good film. And Evil Dead 2, even though, like, you know, there are mistakes in it, you can see the lights here and there and bits like that, but it doesn't matter at all.
No, but Evil Dead 3, I don't get into comedy horror. Just there's something that jars with me.
Did you see the series, Ash vs. Evil Dead?
No.
See, Ash vs. Evil Dead takes the Army of Darkness Ash. So it's very, you know, it's still very good. Don't get me wrong. It's still a lot of fun. Yeah. But, yeah, Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, it's really where it's at.
Proper zombie movies.
They're like... The examples that I give people when they say, why do you like horror movies? Like, because they have no money, so they have to be super creative.
Yeah, for sure.
And they have fun, and it's made out of passion, and there is no flab on these films. There's no flab at all, because they usually don't have the money to process the film. So, I love that. And 28 Days Later is actually a great example of that, because they did all of the empty London scenes at daybreak in summer, so that the streets were empty and they could just get away, and they did it guerrilla style, and I love that.
Yeah, so good.
But anyway, sorry. So, yeah, great, good, thanks.
Can I go now? I'm hungry.
Ken, thank you for joining us. It's been an education.
Thanks, Ken. It's been great to catch up.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Vincent. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.